Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Broadcast around the state thanks to Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, President Trump is apparently talking to his advisors about the possibility of putting Mike Lee on the Supreme Court. Also, Greg Hughes steps down from the Inland Port Board. A judge finds the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Primary elections in Utah play out mostly as expected. And more. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke is in studio. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
And on the phone from Washington, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Good morning, Tommy.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
Thanks for being here. Also, listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions. The number to call is 801-355-8255, or you can post them at sltrib.com. And Thomas Burr, I want to start with you. And the rumors swirling that Mike Lee is on the short list of nominees who might replace Justice Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. Kennedy announced earlier this week that he will retire in July, at the end of July, actually. Tommy, how seriously is the White House considering Utah Senator Mike Lee for the Supreme Court?
Sure, let me back up for just a second and explain. So in the 2016 campaign, then-candidate Donald Trump was a little bit under fire by conservatives about wondering about what kind of justices he would put on the Supreme Court. So he came out with a list, and then they added that list later on. But it was essentially to kind of show his conservative bona fides. He said, you know, I will only pick from this list for the Supreme Court. And for the record, the president has stuck with that. So this week when Kennedy said he would step down from the court, the president said he would still stick by that and pick from that now 25 people on that list, which includes Senator Mike Lee and his brother, Thomas Lee, who's a Utah Supreme Court justice. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, maybe the name is tossed out there as a you know, just to kind of feed the base and make sure everyone's happy. But apparently, Bloomberg's reporting yesterday that that the president was asking about appointing Mike Lee, and his big concern was, well, can he get through, one, and two, if he is appointed the court, you know, can we make sure that Republican-held seat in Utah stays in Republican hands?
Hmm. If that were the only impediment to Mike Lee's being nominated, you would kind of expect that it wouldn't be that much of a problem. Tommy, ideologically, Trump, this list that you talk about, I mean, he's looking for somebody with a specific set of attributes, of beliefs, right? I mean, does Mike Lee fit the bill of someone who kind of checks the boxes of what Trump is looking for?
Yeah, sure. In many cases, you know, obviously Democrats would be not so happy about this pick at all, but because mainly Kennedy has been that swing vote on the court for a while. You know, you have your conservative wing of the court and you have your liberal wing of the court, and then right in the middle there is Kennedy, who has sided with both sides depending on the issue. So Mike Lee is a former federal prosecutor. He was general counsel to then-Governor John Huntsman. He was a clerk to Justice Alito, both on the Supreme Court and at the circuit court level. He's made himself out to be a constitutional authority among his fans, and has, in many ways, you know, stuck with the originalism kind of idea throughout his career. So the president's looking for somebody who's intellectual and just kind of fits that mold of somebody he feels like should be on the court, such as, you know, Neil Gorsuch, who he appointed to fill Justice Antonin Scalia's position.
You know, one way or another, we're talking about the transformation of the Supreme Court because, as you said, Justice Kennedy has at times been a swing voter on abortion, affirmative action, same-sex marriage. On these and other topics, he has sided with the more liberal judges on the court, and then generally he's a conservative, except for when he's not. Robert Gerke, I'm going to bring your voice in on this.
Sure.
You know, I'm going to ask you what I asked Tommy. Trump is probably looking for someone who wouldn't swing the way that Kennedy has. I mean, doesn't
right.
swing the way that Kennedy actually ends up swinging. Is Mike Lee that person?
He's the swinging judge. I think Mike Lee would be much more conservative than Justice Kennedy was, obviously. You know, sometimes, I guess we could clarify, Justice Kennedy was believed to be a conservative when he went on the bench, but then he ended up ruling in, you know, more moderately than he was anticipated. But, you know, Mike Lee would be, he says his judicial role model is Sam Alito, who is, you know, one of them, with the passing of Justice Scalia, is probably the leading conservative on the bench. So I think that's, you know, you would get a major change in the makeup of the court. The other thing about, I think, Mike Lee is that he's still young. Tommy, I think he's still about 50 years old, if I'm not mistaken.
47, I think.
He's 47. So that would change the makeup of the court for probably four decades, mm-hmm. or three decades at least. So, you know, it would be a significant change, but I also, you know, I personally don't think he's got some obstacles, let's put it that way. There's some history there between him and President Trump.
Right. This is about, you wrote about this, in fact, this week, about sort of Mike Lee not having the credentials of having been a loyal Trump supporter from the get-go, and that's something that Trump might consider.
Yeah, I mean, quite the opposite, really. I mean, Tommy and I were in Cleveland for the Republican National Convention when Mike Lee was among the leaders of the revolt that was trying to deny Trump the Republican nomination. Senator Lee wanted to swing it to Ted Cruz, and so he and the Utah delegation were trying to stage this sort of last-second parliamentary maneuver to try to force a vote that could, you know, conceivably have denied Trump the nomination. You know, so that's a, you know, that's disloyal right. act. And then, you know, after the Access Hollywood tape came out, Senator Lee recorded a video where he said that Trump should drop out of the race, and I think was the most prominent and perhaps the only person in the Republican Party to have said that he needed to get out at the time. So, you know, and I think, you know, what we know about President Trump is that he doesn't forget, you know, and he nurses these grudges, and he's you know, if he has this position, he has this, you know, sort of plum job here that, you know, everybody wants. I'm not sure that he's likely to give it to somebody who has shown a lack of commitment to making America great again.
Yeah, I know that one of the other things you pointed out was that he voted for
Evan McMullen.
And
yeah,
said it was a protest vote.
Yeah.
At the time.
So that's three strikes, I guess, right?
Tommy, Trump, according to anonymous sources in the White House in this Bloomberg report, says that he thinks that Lee would be easily confirmed. A simple majority in the Senate is what is needed for that to happen. Democrats, however, have been talking quite a lot about President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland, whose nomination was held up for something like 300 days to prevent him from being confirmed. And that's because he didn't get a hearing. Would Lee or any nominee face that kind of obstruction from the Democrats? Could they do anything like that, Tommy?
Yeah, this is the interesting thing we're going to watch the next few months. One, let's remember that Republicans do control the Senate. Yeah, it's 51-49, right. And Senator McCain is, you know, facing brain cancer, so he's not around to vote, so that makes it really tight. But in this situation, Democrats are saying, hey, wait, you held up President Obama's nominee, as you mentioned, Merrick Garland, for nearly a year. Their argument was this is a presidential election year, and he's, you know, not going to be able to run again, and so we should let the voters decide who should, you know, be the president and pick the nominee. Democrats back in the face. Republicans now saying, wait a second, it's an election year now, too, and we're only a few months away from November. We should wait. That's what Chuck Schumer is saying, the Senate Democratic leader. That's not fair, that we should let the voters decide who controls the Senate and then decide after that. Here's the thing on any confirmation vote. You're not going to get many Democrats to support whoever the president appoints, no matter who it is. In this case, usually a senator gets by a little better because they have relations with other senators, so they know him. You know, Mike Lee has worked with several Democrats over many things. Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota is a great example of they work on a lot of antitrust issues together. That doesn't mean that she's going to support him. And there's still some harsh memories, I think, back to the 2013 government shutdown that Mike Lee was very involved in that will still be haunting him should he be appointed and go through any kind of confirmation process. And let me just add one more thing because sure. We're talking about it, because Senator Lee was talking on Fox and Friends yesterday. Should the vote come up, and since it could be a tight vote, Senator Lee could actually be voting for himself right. to be confirmed to the Supreme Court because, as he said, you're a senator until you're not a senator. So if it came down to, you know, a 50-50 vote kind of situation, Senator Lee could actually vote for himself to be on the Supreme Court.
Hmm. Wow, that's interesting. And is he, I guess he's expressed interest, as you said, in getting this position.
Yeah, his great quote is, I wouldn't say no. But we all know Senator Lee has been, this is his dream job in many ways. He's talked about it before. His father was Solicitor General under President Reagan, and obviously he's been watching the Supreme Court since he was 10 years old, talked about it over, dinner every night. So this is so many ways he's been, eyeing this position for a long time and finally is positioned to maybe get it.
Yeah. I guess another question that occurs to me is how long a confirmation hearing might take. How long might this end up being? We've got Kennedy leaving at the end of July. We have candidates, there's no nomination yet, but I don't know. When will we see this actually be voted on?
Yeah, we also have to remember it's an election year, too. So pretty much the Congress is gone for all of August. So what we're looking at is probably a confirmation process in September and possibly a vote in October. Democrats are going to try to slow it down. But we also have the nuclear option, as it's referred to, is in place. So there's no filibuster possible here. They don't need 60 votes. They need 51.
Yeah, simple majority.
So in so many ways, this could be a pretty swift confirmation process once the nominee's in place.
Robert Gerke, just before we move on to other topics, thinking about that simple majority, can they get that to confirm somebody who, the part of the background here is that they a dream of President Donald Trump or something that he has a stated interest in is overturning Roe v. Wade. If that is the sort of stated aim, can they get that simple majority to confirm someone?
Well, I part of it depends on the nominee. I think there are some on the short list who would have a hard time getting the 50 votes. You've still got some moderate senators. You've got your Susan Collinses of the world. You've got your Jeff Flakes of the world who really don't want to maybe do favors for the president right now. Let's put it that way. So, they can use it as some leverage. They can, there may be some on that list that they wouldn't be inclined to go for. It's not going to take that much, I don't think, for the Democrats to slow this down for a month to push it out past the elections. And then the question becomes, do Republicans gain seats or lose seats? The Democrats could weaken their hand in November if they are able to delay it like that. So, there's a lot of moving pieces. These things typically don't move all that fast, and so I think we'll see it take a little bit of time. And as Tommy mentioned, with the summer break, we're still probably a little ways off before we see the big battle come down on this.
Okay, 31 days until Kennedy steps down, I guess 32 days, and we will see who the nominee is sometime soon and see what happens. Before we head to a break, I want to squeeze in just one more story that played out over the last 2 weeks locally here. With the latest happening on Tuesday, and I'm just going to lay the story out here, Tribune reporter Taylor Anderson broke the news that outgoing House Speaker Greg Hughes had conflicts, land ownership conflicts, that disqualified him from the Inland Port Authority Board, a board that he appointed himself to, by the way. There was talk when the news broke that Hughes would just try to challenge the law to try and allow him to remain on this board, and that maybe that law would get changed during a special session of the legislature. Then this week, Tuesday, he said that he would resign from the board and use his appointment power to instead give his spot to House Majority Whip Francis Gibson. Those are the facts. Robert Gerke, Greg Hughes is going to leave the legislature, but he won't be on this board, and essentially because he couldn't be on this board under the law, right?
Right. Well, so if you remember the history of this bill, the Senate passed a version of the bill that had a 2-mile buffer around the footprint of what is supposed to be the inland port. And it said, if you own property, if you own investment property, it's not your residence doesn't count, but if you own investment property within 2 miles of this vicinity, you can't serve on the board because it's a conflict of interest. The thinking being that you could either vote against things because you don't want more traffic through there, or vote for things because you want to drive up your property value. And so Greg Hughes owns a lot of apartments. Taylor and I, we found 9 of them within a the House changed it to a 5-mile buffer, so so he kind of messed things up for himself a little bit there. There was one that was within 2 miles, but 8 others that were within 5 miles. And so, you know, his argument was, well, that doesn't really matter, you know, or we shouldn't have this in there in the first place. He pointed to Councilman James Rogers, who has a part ownership in a building up in Northwest Salt Lake. And so he's like, we should just take it out. And it was interesting because neither the governor, really nobody, you know, put up a fight about it. It seemed a little self-serving, right? If you don't like the law that they just passed and changed the law, I guess. And then he did this about face and reverse course, and now he's going to be stepping down. I think Greg really wanted to be on this board. He has been sort of the leading proponent of this Inland Port Authority. He's been the one negotiating with, you know, in some cases the city, in some cases Senator DeBacchus. It's sort of his baby. So it was probably a lot for him to give up.
Did you know, Hughes said that he didn't know, essentially, that he had an interest in these investment properties near to the – I mean, how do you end up in the position of not knowing
He knew he had the properties. I don't think he, you know, sat down with the map and figured out, you know, the distance, the, you know. And it's interesting because they did – the way the port footprint is constructed, there's this sliver that runs along the I-80, I-215 interchange.
Right.
And, you know, you take that out, then a couple of the other properties would fall out of that 5-mile buffer. But the house, again, they insisted on the 5-mile radius, and they insisted on that piece being in the footprint. So they kind of did it to themselves.
Got it.
In trying to, you know, and really they did it in the process of trying to be a little vindictive and roll the city on this thing.
So, you know, okay, Greg Hughes, Speaker.
Roger, how many of them? Totally forgotten how many investment properties we have.
Mean those 9 apartments?
Yeah, a long-lost relative dies and leaves you the titles, and you just don't know that you have them. That was my theory of how you have an excuse.
I mean, one of them was, like, literally about 1.7 miles, so it's pretty close, you know. But
so Greg Hughes is off the board, but he did, as you pointed out, Robert Kirky, he sort of shepherded this through the legislature. On the board or off, he could potentially benefit from inland port development. I mean...
If the logic behind having the buffer, the conflict of interest requirement, if the premise of that is that you don't want people self-dealing, then there's still some benefit to be had. I think, you know, these properties are, most of them are sort of over, you know, on the 8th South corridor, and are a decent distance away from where there's going to be any actual real port activity. So
5 miles.
I don't know that there's an argument to be made that he's going to, you know, make a lot of bank on this, but I think they put the rule in place and then decided, I guess, they didn't want to abide by it, but now he's going to.
I would imagine that other reporters or the port reporters there at the paper are now hard at work looking to see how many additional lawmakers in the legislature stand to benefit directly from the development of this thing. I doubt that that's a question
you've got so many. I mean, any of these big projects like this, including, you know, Senate President Wayne Niederhauser had property out by the prison site, you know. You've got Brad Wilson, who had property up in Layton where there was a big development project. We've got so many developers in the legislature and so many people who own investment properties like Greg does. You run into this kind of thing all the time.
And then the other question is, what is Hughes going to do between now and 2020?
There was talk for a while that he might have a job in the Trump administration. Maybe he'll be a Supreme Court judge. No, I'm just kidding.
Guys, we need to head.
We'll run some apartment buildings.
Exactly. Just be a land manager. We need to head to our first break of the show, and there is more news from the Salt Lake Tribune reported this past week. Just ahead, this is Behind the Headlines. We'll be right back.
I'm Robin Young. This week saw big Supreme Court decisions and Justice Kennedy's announced retirement.
And I'm very honored that he chose to do it during my term in office because he felt confident in me to make the right choice and carry on his great legacy. That's why he did it.
Our political roundtable convenes next time, Here and Now.
Join us for Hour 2 of Here and Now today at noon on Utah Public Radio.
This week in This American Life, Andrew Collins was a crooked cop. Over 60 cases of his were overturned when the truth came out. He got thrown in prison for it, turned over a new leaf. But the problem is, he lives in such a small town that it's hard for him to avoid bumping into people who he totally screwed over as a cop.
It always starts with a glance, and I know it's about to come. They'd be like, Collins?
That's his week.
Join us tomorrow morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, columnist Robert Gerke, and joining us in studio now is public lands reporter Brian Maffley. Good morning, Brian.
Hey, hi, Roger.
This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com. On to some other news from this past week, and Brian Maffley, a Canadian firm called Glacier Lake Resources Incorporated, says that it is pursuing plans to mine in a section of Utah that President Trump axed from a national monument here in the state.
Yeah.
Where and what does this company want to mine?
Well,
Brian?
What it says it wants to mine, I think... It is interested in a old copper mine in the what we call the Circle Cliffs, east of the town of Boulder. It's at the far eastern end of the former monument, almost in Capitol Reef National Park, maybe a couple miles just outside. And when the monument was reduced under President Trump's order last year, it did a couple things. One was it lifted what we call mineral withdrawal on those lands. It's about 900,000 acres in that used to be in the monument. That meant that after February 2nd, people could go in and file mining claims in the relevant county offices. In this case, it would have been in Panguitch in Garfield County. So without any very little fanfare, anyone even really noticing, back in April, these prospectors, a guy named Proctor, filed these claims, 10 claims on what was an old mine there. And so this company, Glacier Lake, apparently gets a hold of the claims and puts out this press release, obviously targeting investors, talking about how they plan to start looking for cobalt and copper on this location this summer. There's a lot of problems with that.
I was going to say, I mean, Trump signed this proclamation in December, as you said.
Yeah.
Can a company just now start mining?
Of course not. Okay. And what's happening now is those lands are still managed under the Monument Management Plan, which is no, you know, industrial activities, obviously. And the BLM's in the process of coming up with a new plan. A lot of work will go into that. That's at least a year away. Mm. And then you know, assuming that plan will then allow mining in this lovely area, Circle Cliffs. It's really gorgeous. It's not pristine, obviously, because there's been historic mining there, but it's very close to Water Pocket Fold in the park. It's on the border of the Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. I mean, it's not very accessible. You know, it's not the so it may never even be eligible for mining. But then we also have all these lawsuits challenging the Trump's order for that, and the Bears Ears Monument as well.
You wrote that the Bureau of Land Management was kind of caught off guard by this, you know, the press release from this company. And what do they say about it?
Were they off guard? They had to have known that people were going to be interested in filing claims on the former monument land. So, yes, but they didn't really know about it. So when I sought them for comment, they really weren't particularly helpful. They would just say that, you know, but here's this company putting out this press release saying they're going to do something this summer that they cannot possibly do legally, and, you know, start digging for minerals. So, but the BLM wouldn't say, or they referred my calls upstairs to the Department of Interior, and they would just say, no, we're restoring these lands to multiple use, and we don't have any applications for ground disturbing activities yet, and we will process it when it comes in.
So this, I mean, is this potentially kind of a PR campaign to draw in investors? I mean, you hinted at this, that it's just trying to get investors for this company.
I'm not taking this company very seriously. They won't return any of the phone calls the many media have made to them. I think they're trying to look for investments, investors, and even more, I think they're also trying to possibly get some kind of property right established there before this thing gets resolved in the courts, so that if the monument is reestablished, wow, they have this little mining claim in holding in a very critical place. Maybe they can get rich environmentalists to buy their claim out.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's interesting. So there could be that as a real point in the works.
Glacier Lake Resources is not a company with a lot of assets. They're based in Vancouver, BC, it looks like they don't have that many active mineral production going.
Robert Gerke, the confusion and attempts to potentially or maybe or conceivably mine inside of lands cut from national monuments, in this case from the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, your sort of take on that?
Well, it's not surprising, right? I mean, there was talk about this from the time that the monument was withdrawn, and I think Brian's point about the potential for a buyout, they're angling for a buyout, is a distinct possibility, right? I mean, it's tough to mine down there. It oftentimes takes a lot of resources to try to just to get it off the ground. But if you can get a paycheck for doing nothing except for staking a claim, then why not do it?
Did they buy the claim from this guy who went out and staked it?
Who knows? Okay, I can't get a hold of that guy. And it's also worth noting that this land is a former state trust land section, and in the late 90s, of course, Congress passed legislation to enable a very costly buyout of those state trust lands. So it's like to the tune of $50 million. So wouldn't it be strange that the taxpayers pay $50 million to get these state trust lands, only to years later allow them to be mined? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Yeah.
What about the lawsuits? I mean, you mentioned them, but the lawsuits that have been filed that are against the undoing of national monuments or the downsizing of national monuments, those are still playing out, right?
Yeah, there have been 5 lawsuits, 2 involving Trump's order to reduce the Grand Staircase, and 3 targeting his Bears Ears order. All 5 have been consolidated in a court in Washington, D.C., and the judge in the case is hearing motions to have the venue changed out here to Salt Lake City, brought by I believe that either the federal government or the state of Utah would obviously like it moved out here as well.
And it kind of plays into what we were talking about earlier with the Supreme Court judge, the Supreme Court vacancy, because that's where ultimately these lawsuits are going to end up. And if you, again, as we discussed, the makeup of the court is changing significantly with Justice Kennedy's retirement.
And so would Antiquities Act be something that might be, I don't know, or that, I guess these lawsuits would be, the Antiquities Act wouldn't be changed necessarily, but the interpretation of the Antiquities Act?
Just the question of, they all deal with the same fundamental question of whether President Trump has the authority to rescind a previous, or to shrink a previously created monument.
Yeah, Robert, that's a huge question, really one the Supreme Court ought to take up.
And so there's only 2 cases, one over Bears Ears and one over Grand Staircase, and like Brian said, the judge is weighing and hasn't ruled for a while on these motions to consolidate them. I'm sorry to move the venue, but we expect a decision somewhat soon. It's been long enough.
On when or whether they're going to move the venue. We'll pay attention to that. Hey, I want to stay on the public lands front for a little while longer here and talk about one of the plaintiffs in one of these lawsuits challenging the action on national monuments. This is the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance.
Yeah.
SUA also had challenged some meetings that were held related to Trump's action, and those were meetings between Utah counties and the Trump administration. SUA in court said that those secret meetings were not legal, and that suit got tossed by a judge. Brian, that's not the end of the story, though. There's more that happened this week on this front.
It gets more entertaining. Yeah, so what SUA was alleging that when the San Juan County Commission met with Secretary Zinke, they should have done that in a public session. They filed a lawsuit over that, as well as another lawsuit over Kane and Garfield County's meetings with Secretary Zinke regarding the Grand Staircase. And in all those meetings, these county commissioners were lobbying the secretary to, in the case of the Bears Ears, get rid of the monument, and in the case of the Grand Staircase, make it drastically smaller. So Sua, and I think this is a reasonable position here, was like, you know, this, you have all three commissioners meeting a top federal official. These commissioners obviously are going to have a lot of influence in whatever decisions ultimately made. They should have been open to the public. They should have been noticed. And so they filed these lawsuits. And the first one, which is against San Juan County, gets thrown out of court by Judge Lyle Anderson. So Judge Anderson, on no motion from the county, decides that the lawsuit was so empty of merit to the point that it was actually intended to simply harass the county and prevent them from interacting with federal officials. And now he's ordering Sua to pay their legal fees, which was not a ton of money, just a few thousand dollars.
For San Juan County.
For San Juan County.
But there are other counties who are also saying, yeah, maybe we can get our legal fees reimbursed as well.
Well, yeah. And so the outside lawyers for Kane and Garfield County in the other case now have cited Judge Anderson's ruling to say, hey, we want our fees too. And believe me, those would be a lot more money. These were high-dollar lawyers. Hmm. There's probably a lot more money at stake on that side. However, that judge may decide that, no, this was a legitimate lawsuit. I mean, it's a case that really needs to get heard. I mean, what are the rules here?
Right. Yeah. How big of a role did these meetings play in what the Trump administration ended up doing?
Well, they're obviously crucial. The judges in both cases determined that, hey, county commissions have no control or jurisdiction over the designation of national monuments. So therefore, since they have no say, then we don't need to have those open.
Well, essentially, the Secretary of Interior makes these decisions.
The president does.
The president, yeah, sorry.
Or Congress, right? So,
go on, though. I interrupted you.
Yeah.
The point being that...
Yeah, but the point being was here, well, Sua said in their filings, look, the president and the Secretary of Interior pointed out what the county wanted when they made these decisions to shrink these two monuments. You know, maybe they didn't do exactly what the counties asked for, but they came close enough and they talked about how this land ought to be controlled by local authorities. So to say that these county commissioners had no kind of advisory role, yeah, clearly they don't have jurisdiction, but that they didn't have an advisory role, that doesn't really, that's a strange argument to make, because they obviously did.
Yeah. Robert Gerke, the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance is reviled by a lot of politicians.
That's putting it mildly, Roger.
Southern Utah, and... what I'm wondering is this judge's decision a kind of reflection of the contempt that exists in Southern Utah toward environmentalists in general?
Yes, but also I think we got to remember this is Lyle Anderson too. I mean, Lyle Anderson is the same judge who's been had this Rose Chilcote case.
Yeah, it's his last day on the bench today, by the way.
The rancher the environmentalist who has been charged with, you know, freeing these cattle. He's a bit of a wingnut, I think, and he's going out in a blaze of glory. When he ran for office previously, he ran on a hardline anti-SUA campaign. The fact that this shows up is he's on his way out the door is fundamentally, you know, for him to say that the case has no merit. I mean, the Open Meetings Act on its face says when a quorum of a body meets, they need to have it as an open meeting.
Yeah.
If that doesn't have merit, if you don't like the law, that's fine, but that's what the law says, and the legislature needs to change it if that's not what they meant. But to say it doesn't have merit, I think, is to do it on his own accord and say that it's a frivolous case on his own accord without even having a motion.
It's more than frivolous. You have to be more than frivolous to get sanctioned.
Yeah.
You have to be... trying to harass and intimidate your opponent in court.
And Sue is fighting this fine, this will be probably heard in an additional...
It's already on appeal.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, we will see what happens. I want to actually turn to a kind of related story, and it has to do with primary elections that took place on Tuesday, and there's a lot from primary elections we can talk about, but I thought that we might start with... since we've been talking about San Juan County and public lands, not the highest profile race, but there was an apparent upset for the Democratic nominee for a county commission seat there in San Juan County. And again, it plays into the conversation about national monuments, about public lands. Both Robert and Brian have written about this. Who wants to break the news here?
You go for it, Robert.
Well, I think, I mean, it sort of got overlooked, but Rebecca Benally, who was a county commissioner down in San Juan County, and was sort of the leading opponent of the Bears Ears National Monument, at least the leading Navajo spokesperson against the monument. She was in D.C. She was at the, you know, when President Trump rescinded the monument, she was, you know, there with the delegation, you know, and she met President Trump. She's been very active in opposing the monument. She was beaten by Kenneth Maryboy, who was on the board of Utah Dene Bekea, who the group of tribes that was advocating for the monument. So, you know, this could be seen, I think, as a sort of referendum of support for the monument in that, you know, at least in that commission district. It's also kind of interesting, frankly, that you know, the way the district has been drawn, it actually should have favored Rebecca, and she still ended up losing by it appears by about 50-60 votes.
Hmm. Well, but this is, again, I mean, this is the Democratic primary. I think a lot of people were surprised to learn at some point that Rebecca Benally was a Democrat, because she was so pro-monument and there with Trump again on the day of the signing.
She's anti-monument.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, anti-monument. Thank you, Brian. How Brian Maffley, public lands reporter of the Tribune, how big of a deal is Kenneth Maryboy's upset of Rebecca Benally there?
Well, I think it's a really huge deal because it sets up a situation where San Juan County could have not just one, but two Bears Ears Monument proponents on the county commission. In the other district race, the chairman of the Utah Dene Bekea board, Willie Gray Eyes, was the Democrats' choice for that seat, formerly held by Phil, or still held by Phil Lyman. However, there's a dispute over Willie Gray Eyes's whether his candidacy is legitimate or not, and that's going to be decided in the courts. So if he does prevail and wins that election, which is now in the redistricting is a Navajo majority district, then you have two Bears Ears proponents on that county commission. Robert, what kind of dilemma is that going to pose to the governor?
Well, it's kind of, well, you're right. I think you'll stop hearing them saying that, you know, we need to listen to the local elected officials on these issues. that will probably go away. I think, you know, the die has been cast, I think, in a lot of ways, because the monument order's already come out. But San Juan County is a party to this lawsuit right now, the lawsuits we talked about that are challenging or trying to, you know.
Actually, they're not. They haven't been allowed to intervene yet.
Well, they filed a motion to intervene, I guess, is what I should say, yeah. You know, and so maybe they drop that. Maybe they stop challenging it. Maybe they, you know, there's a lot that could play out. And even Brian mentioned the Willie Gray Eyes case, where his residence in the state has been challenged and whether he's eligible to run. Even if he loses that lawsuit, the Democratic Party has until August if he loses to appoint a replacement for him on the ballot. So, it probably is a district that would tip to the Democrats. It's, you know, it would be a pretty major shift, I think, in the political scene down in San Juan County.
And there's also, I know, a court challenge or a request to reopen the voting rights case. This is a request to Robert Shelby, the judge, based on things like kicking Willie Gray Eyes off the ballot. Guys, we have to take another quick break here, and then when we return, we should turn to some other primary elections that happened on Tuesday. And we'll also look at some recycling fees in Utah that may be going up. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and AARP Utah, a nonpartisan social change organization with a membership helping people 50 and over improve their lives by providing materials, programs, and advocacy on key issues. More information is available at aarp.org.
I'm Greg Dalton, and on the next Climate One, we dig into the controversy over GMOs and glyphosate, the active ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup weed killer.
Glyphosate is a probable carcinogen.
Glyphosate is not a carcinogen.
A Monsanto executive and company critic also debate the safety of eating GMOs and growing food in a hot and crowded world. On the next Climate One.
Join us this morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Apogee Instruments, a Cache Valley company building precision sensors that support global research in sustainable food production, renewable energy, and climate change.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley, Thomas Burr, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments. 801-355-8255. That's 355-TALK if you want to join this conversation. Again, primary elections happened on Tuesday. I want to bring Thomas Burr back into this conversation because we had a Republican Senate and House primary going on, and Mitt Romney and John Curtis were the favorites, and the outcome here was, Tommy, pretty predictable, I think, right?
Yeah, and that's pretty much how our polls called it, actually, when it comes down to it. So we all kind of knew that Mitt Romney was going to win this primary against State Rep Mike Kennedy. Our poll showed 42-point margin, and he won with 43 points. So there you go.
All right.
Good job, Hinckley Institute, on that poll. It's one of those, it's hard to beat somebody with such name recognition as Mitt Romney. And when it comes to the John Curtis versus Chris Herod race, you know, incumbency has its benefits. And in this case, John Curtis is a congressman, and he's now, you know, on his way to, once he gets past the general, to an actual full term in the House.
All right. You know, both of these candidates conceivably could have wrapped this up in the Republican convention, right, if they'd won enough of the delegate votes, but that didn't happen. They had to face this primary. Maybe I'll bring Robert Gerke in on this and ask, what does the fact that they, you know, one of them, Mitt Romney, lost in convention and then won, you know, wildly in the primary. What does that say about the convention system in general?
They're totally irrelevant. I mean, it doesn't really matter anymore. As you mentioned, Mitt Romney got 49% at convention. He got 73%, I think, in the primary. I think that shows a vast disconnect between the viewpoints of the delegates who go to convention and the mainstream Republican primary voters who vote for the candidates in a primary. And I think it's hard for the defenders of the convention to argue otherwise at this point, because we've seen it again and again. We saw it with Governor Herbert, who got beat at convention and won in the primary. We saw it with John Curtis last year, who finished fifth at convention and won the primary. We've seen it now with Mitt Romney. We've seen it with John Curtis again. And, you know, I think at some point, you know, and there were actually a couple other races, Brad Last down in southern Utah. He won by six at the convention, still had to go to the primary, and ended up winning by, I think, 46 points. So, you know, there's just this vast disconnect between the two. And
Because of the disconnect between voters and the delegates.
Because delegates tend to come from the right wing of the Republican Party and the left wing of the Democratic Party. They're the more strident, and they vote for candidates who don't reflect the viewpoints of mainstream voters.
Okay. Well, circling back to just the primary election itself and what's happening next, Tommy Burr, Mitt Romney is going to face Salt Lake County Councilwoman Jenny Wilson in November. She says that she promises a tough fight.
You know, and she's going to work it. I've known Jenny for a long time, and she's really working hard. She knows what she's up against. Mitt Romney's a household name. He's got millions of dollars, and, you know, the resources are endless. And despite the fact that all the, you know, Republicans are going to vote his way and independents swing his way, but she's trying, and she knows, again, she's up against a tough opponent, but it's not deterring her in many ways, because she believes in a good race. I also love to bring up the fact that she worked for him at one point during the Olympics. Jenny was doing some volunteer coordinating while Mitt was the head of the Olympic Committee.
So they can both point to the success of
they
the Olympics.
They both take credit for the success of the 2000.
They both rescued him, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I want to turn, you know, there's a number of other races. Actually, we should talk about John Curtis. He's going up against, the name is escaping me now, for the Democratic nominee for November. Yeah, Singer is his name. Thank you. Yeah, Courage Singer, and I can't think of his
James yeah.
Courage Singer. How about a preview of that race, either Robert or Tommy?
I mean, it's we've got two districts in this state, the first and the third, who that both have about a 22 to 24 point Republican lean, they call it, an advantage of registered Republicans in the district. So those are incredibly long odds, I think. But, you know, I think it's, you know, these are hard races for Democrats. The second and fourth are a little bit less Republican heavy. So, you know, you've got the Ben McAdams race in the fourth against Mia Love, and you've got Chris Stewart and Shireen Grabani in the second. So, you know, those could be more competitive, perhaps. Mm-hmm. One of the things, going back to Mitt Romney, that I noticed on Wednesday looking at the election results was the overwhelming number of Republicans who came out and voted in a primary. The turnout was really shocking. Mm-hmm. Over 300,000 Republicans, 302,000, and there's still votes to be counted, came out and voted. There's about 630,000 registered Republicans in the state. So you had almost 50% turnout, which is pretty huge in a primary, and I think maybe could show that Mitt might have some coattails. And if there's voter enthusiasm going into November, Mitt could bring out the vote and help candidates like Mia Love, and who could be in a close race. Our poll has it at about 6 points right now.
Tommy, was the big turnout, I mean, was Mitt the draw for that turnout? It's, I guess you just have to guess, but...
Yeah, and we're all speculating here, but certainly I think people were fired up this year. Sorry, there's an ambulance.
Fired up.
I know, yeah, fired up. Literally, I got sirens for you right now. I think people are excited, and everyone's paying attention to politics now. This is a situation that I think is good in some ways for the country. People are listening and reading and involved. I'm going to bring out a point that McAdams' campaign points out all the time, which is that Ben McAdams won re-election in 2012 when Mitt Romney was the GOP nominee for president, and Ben won re-election. So they're saying there's no coattails with Romney. We'll see this November, I guess.
Well, yeah, and in that McAdams love race, Ben's bread and butter, his real shot at winning this is trying to get crossover Republicans and most of the unaffiliateds. I mean, Matheson had a pretty good formula where he had to get about 12% of the Republican vote, win the unaffiliateds, and hold on to the Democrats. And that, I think that formula still holds.
Well, we'll see what happens in November. There's a lot. There are a number of state House primary races that we didn't talk about. There's a reliable Democratic seat in Senate District 2 that was held by State Senator Jim DeBacus. Jennifer Plum and Derek Kitchen were in this race, and it appears that Derek Kitchen, Salt Lake City Councilman Derek Kitchen, won that. Slim margin, though.
Yeah, Jennifer Plum really made a race of this. I think Derek was the better-known candidate. He'd run for office before, obviously, for Salt Lake City Council. He was noteworthy because he was the plaintiff in Kitchen v. Herbert, which was the same-sex marriage case. So, you know, coming in, he was probably a heavy favorite. But Jennifer Plum, who's a pediatric doctor, who has worked on, you know, naloxone. I can't say it.
Yeah, okay.
But anyway, so she made it. She, for a first-time candidate, she worked her tail off and made this a really competitive race.
There's another Democratic race. This is House District 24 being vacated by Rebecca Chavez Houck.
Yeah.
Four candidates in that race, two going head-to-head, and this one I think is still too close to call. It's between Jen Daly Provost and Igor Lemansky, and another spot where it's kind of low turnout, and candidates having to try and find a way to distinguish themselves to try and get this.
Well, here's the fact. Here's something that nobody's really talked about that I didn't even realize until Election Day. If you are not a registered Democrat, you don't get a ballot in the mail, even if you can vote in their primaries. If you're an unaffiliated voter who, you know, maybe supports a Democratic candidate or wants to vote in these primaries, which if you live in these areas, you should, because chances are the Democrat's going to win the seat in November, so that's your only chance to get a say in it. If you're unaffiliated, you've got to go down to the polling place and actually cast your ballot. So mm-hmm. I think that really depressed turnout in several of these races. This one is coming down to the wire, and so we got to wait and see when the canvas comes how
there are
out.
So many other primary races that we're just not going to be able to get to, and I had teased the idea of talking about recycling here, but we have to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, our final segment. segment of the show, and so what I'll maybe do is give it to Brian Maffley for first pick for underplayed story of the week, Brian.
Clearly it is the high cost of curbside recycling in Salt Lake City.
Why is that the case, Brian? Why might the cost of curbside recycling be going up?
Well, there's two things. One is we're putting too much junk and garbage in our recycle bins that drives up the cost of processing it, and the other end is the markets for particularly plastic in China has gone utterly soft, partly because it's the plastic, recycled plastic we're sending to China is in such bad quality. So that's my underplayed story of the week.
Thanks for doing that. There's a list I thought that was kind of interesting. There's a list that residents can check out on what can and cannot go into their recycling bin. Among them, you know, plastic bags can't go in, and neither can styrofoam. Things that I didn't know, Brian. I mean, I knew the plastic.
Yeah, greasy pizza boxes.
Not
big no-no.
Okay. All right, some tips on recycling from Brian Maffley. You can check it out at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I'm going to use this opportunity for a public service announcement. We've got 7 wildfires burning in the state right now, yeah, including a big one down in central Utah, about 4,000 acres. I was down in central Utah last week, and it was just bone dry. I mean, it was shocking for this time of year how dry it was down there. The governor has imposed fire restrictions on state lands. The Salt Lake City has imposed fireworks restrictions over the next month. We got to be careful out there because we are in a drought situation across most of the state right now, and we don't need thousands of acres burning because some dummy wants to go light off fireworks in a dry field. So be careful out there.
Okay, with the 4th of July coming up. Thomas Burr, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
One, my mother would, in Central Utah, would really appreciate what Robert Gerke just did. you know, I feel like this is like a century ago, but, you know, on Sunday last week, Sarah Sanders went to a restaurant in Virginia, and the restaurant owner came in and politely asked her to leave. She and her group did. But now Sarah Sanders is getting Secret Service protection. So I guess if you're asked to leave a restaurant, you therefore deserve Secret Service protection.
Because, I mean, is it directly tied to that, the sort of harassment that, it, you know?
You know, I think this probably goes to some other threats she may have had before, okay. but it's kind of unprecedented in many ways. I don't remember the last White House spokesman to receive Secret Service protection.
Now she's going to have an even harder time getting into restaurants because she's got an entourage.
Got to make that other table available.
Right.
Table for 20. I'm going to go for my part with a story that Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins wrote, and it is how refugee advocates in Utah responded to the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the Trump administration's travel ban, which prohibits travel to the U.S. from a number of predominantly Muslim countries. Interesting perspectives from people who have fled violence and war to get here on what that decision means, their sort of take on that. You can find it and the rest of the stories that we covered today at the Tribune's website, sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, Brian Maffley, and Thomas Burr, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, man.
That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much to KCPW's Jesse Ellis and also to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan, as well as to our producer, Emily Means. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Again, thanks. We'll see you next week.
Now that President Trump isn't separating migrant families, there's a new plan: lock them up together.
What they're proposing in place of family separation is a return to the early days of family detention, where families were detained indefinitely.
Family confinement has a long history. Legal advocates are preparing for a major battle. Also, the latest on the shooting at an Annapolis newspaper. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us today from 3 to 6:30 on Utah Public Radio.
As Denny approached the river, he felt as though his life had been a piece of bark on that river, just going along, not thinking at all, headed toward the waterfall.
Ellen Burstyn reads Elizabeth Strout. This week on Selected Shorts, from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us Sunday afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard and streaming online at upr.org.